You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodore class. That's Commodore's Obvious, Misfit, Sean, Lee, David, Torso and Pinches, Matt, Hangman Strain, Sir Rancid Cheese, Shelby, Andrew, Axios, Richard, Hartman, Skipper, The Sextant, Brian, Cap'n Crunch, Roger the Jolly, Vibran, Artemis Killmeister, Carcos, Rotary Coast, M.D., Lost Again, The Navigator, Vasios, Doc Lindsay, Pitlock, Ward, Workman, Chairboat, Gunsway Sally, Cannon Monkey, Rum Runner, Madam Anita Sparrow, Heyfei, Bull, Vertigon, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. In 1700, after the post-war negotiations and partition agreements were breaking down, Louis XIV of France said to his foreign ambassador, now that war appeared to be on the horizon, quote, "When one begins a war, one does not know the finish." End quote. And war was a subject about which Louis XIV was maybe better qualified to speak than any other person in the world. Maybe not the intricate specifics of leading men in battle, but the big picture stuff, yeah. The story of the Sun King is a story of war. But the days when Louis was sculpted in the image of the war god Mars were, by 1700, long gone. He was 62 at this point, and already he was thinking more about his legacy than his personal glory. He'd already won all the personal glory he needed. However, he had sons to think about. He had a lot of sons, in fact, but most of them were illegitimate. He had only one son that could inherit the throne, named Louis. Happily, Louis, the Grand Dauphin, had three sons of his own. The eldest of those was also named Louis. Le Petit Dauphin, the Big Prince and the Little Prince, to signify that one was the heir and one was second in line. That was the line of succession for the French throne. And both the Grand and Petit Dauphin were in good health. The French royal line seemed to be in good shape. But Louis's son, the Grand Dauphin, had two other sons. The youngest of those, Charles, was doomed to spend his life as a spare, a backup for all of the titles held by other men in his family. The middle son, though, that is, Louis XIV's middle grandson, well, he was bright, motivated, and more than anything, ambitious. At this point in the story, he's about 17 years old. He wanted more than a simple dukedom, but considering his older brother was in line for the throne, that seemed like it was going to be about as high as his ambitions could reach. But then, the question of the Spanish succession arose. That man's name was Philippe, Duc d'Anjou, and he had a good claim on the Spanish throne. Really, all of them did, thanks to their grandmother, Maria Teresa of Spain, Louis's first wife. But both the Grand and Petit Dauphin were slated for the throne of France. They were ineligible for the throne of Spain. However, Philippe here, he was not in line for the throne, so he was eligible. And I think I said last time that Louis really wanted his son on the throne of Spain, but that was incorrect. It's his grandson here. However, any hopes he may have had for the Spanish throne were dashed in the treaty negotiations after the Nine Years' War. That's when a Bavarian prince from the House of Wittelsbach was named heir to the Spanish throne. The ailing King Carlos II of Spain even added the Prince of Wittelsbach to his will. But then, that Bavarian prince died of smallpox just a couple of weeks later, and the question of the Spanish succession was thrown right back up in the air. If they weren't careful here, all of this could descend into another disastrous war. This is episode 301. One does not know the finish. When Joseph Ferdinand Wittelsbach died, it sent diplomatic couriers scuttling all over Europe, from London to Amsterdam and Paris, Madrid, Vienna. It was a hectic few weeks while everyone wrestled with the fact that Spain no longer had a proper heir. And you know, I love these stories. Stories about monarchies that are aimed squarely at war, but when their diplomats are busy trying with every fiber of their being to avert the war. You know, you've got these men who are all polite, erudite, educated people, some of the top men in their fields. And they're working as hard as they can to stop this war, to bring about peace. But at any point, if any of the kings whom they served got their fifis hurt, well, all their work was undone, and they're going back to war. Men will begin to die by the thousands, and everyone just seems to agree that, yep, this is exactly how God wants us to do things. It's crazy. I also said last time that Joseph Ferdinand was not a Habsburg, and technically that's true. His father was an unaffiliated Bavarian lord. But his mother was a Habsburg. She was the most Habsburgian Habsburg ever to Habsburg. By which I mean she was the most inbred Habsburg ever to live. Maria Antonia Josepha Benedicta Rosalia Petronella of Austria had been the heir to the Spanish throne. But she died when she was still only 23 years old, well before her uncle, Carlos II. And when I say she's the most inbred Habsburg ever to live, her father was her mother's uncle. And on her mother's side, her grandfather was her grandmother's uncle. And of course, all of them are also, at the same time, cousins of one degree or another, so you can see why she had such a strong claim to a Habsburg throne. It's easy when your family tree is a straight line. But that's why her son, Joseph Ferdinand, was chosen for the throne of Spain. However, of course, he died. And at this point, nobody knew what to do. There were really only two choices for the throne of Spain. There was Philippe, the French prince, and then there was an Austrian prince, son of Emperor Leopold I, named Charles. Diplomats for both Louis XIV and William III of England met at The Hague and tried to hash out a new plan, and for a while it looked like they had a good one. They decided that Charles, youngest son of the Holy Roman Emperor, would get the throne of Spain. It's a major coup for Leopold I. In return, though, France would get most of Italy. They would get Naples, Milan, and Sicily. But that wouldn't go to the King of France. Instead, that would go to the other potential heir to the throne of Spain, Philippe. See, at this point, Spain controlled those Italian provinces, and they were partitioning those out. But that's the crux of the agreement here. You know, the emperor's youngest son would get Spain, but Spain and the empire could never officially reunite. King Louis's grandson would get huge swaths of Italy, but those Italian provinces could never unite with France. That's the deal. That's how everyone agreed that this was going to have to work, if it was going to work. And you may be thinking, doesn't that look almost exactly like the old treaty signed between Leopold and Louis back in 1672? And yes, it does look almost exactly like that old treaty. So, everyone should be happy, right? Well, no. Leopold I, Holy Roman Emperor, was not party to these negotiations, and when he heard the results, he was not happy at all. He had his own intentions for those Italian provinces, namely, bringing them into the Holy Roman Empire. Emperor Leopold said at this point, quote, "Our condition would be very wretched if we were to give France what she asks," end quote. So what changed between 1672 and 1699? Why was this plan no longer good enough for Emperor Leopold? Well, the answer is simple. The Duchy of Savoy. Savoy was that imperial holding in the most northern reaches of what you could call Italy. And as we discussed last time, Duke Victor Amadeus II sort of switched sides from the emperor to Louis back during the 9 Years' War. Savoy was kind of the key to Italy. With Savoy in his pocket, as well as now Naples, Sicily, and Milan, suddenly, Italy itself was vulnerable. The Pope, the Papal States, and all of those other little principalities in central Italy, well, they would be much more amenable to French suggestions. They would almost certainly fall out of Habsburg orbit and right into the orbit of Louis XIV. We might have even had a Kingdom of Italy a couple of centuries early. A powerful new kingdom, allied not to Austria, but to France. To Leopold I, this was just unacceptable. And I kind of get it, you know, that's not good. But come on, man, you're about to get the Spanish Empire. That's like half the world. For Italy. You're going to get the Philippines, the West Indies, Mexico, South America, big swaths of North America, and all you have to do is give up Italy. And yeah, Italy's great, I'm not trying to insinuate otherwise, but how many operable gold mines did Italy have in 1700? A lot less than the rest of the world. How much silk was produced in Italy? How many rare spices and exotic dyes? The math here seems to me to be crystal clear. Especially when your other option is war. A war that you literally cannot afford. You don't have the money, or the manpower, or the food reserves to fight another war. And it's even more of a problem because at this very moment, other wars were breaking out that impacted the Holy Roman Empire. First of all, never to be ignored by Vienna, the Ottoman Empire was building up troop levies in Greece, and that's never a good thing. But even more pressing at this moment was the Great Northern War. While Leopold was busy hemming and hawing, Sweden was invading Denmark. Now, Denmark-Norway, a single kingdom at this point, they were not part of the Holy Roman Empire. However, Saxony, Hanover, and Prussia, who had serious interests in Denmark, were part of the empire. And all three states were sucked into the war. Beyond that, though, Poland and even Russia were getting in on the action. This was shaping up to be a huge conflict with giant armies clashing all over Europe. All of these powers were aimed squarely at the King of Sweden, Charles XII. Now, the Great Northern War was going to last about 20 years, which is impressive considering everybody was allied against them, but Charles XII was up to it. He's honestly one of the best generals that ever lived. Military history nerds tend to remember him like they remember Napoleon or Julius Caesar. He's that good. In the end, he really only made one big mistake, but it was a big one. Charles XII invaded Russia, and it killed him. And it ended badly, as you might expect. So when you've got a war like this breaking out, a war that will, in just a couple of years, involve the Ottoman Empire on your southern border, That's something that really should have concerned Leopold I, but he seems to have been instead really just laser-focused on France. Regardless of all the pressures that should have made him sign this partition agreement, he refused to do so. He would not sign off on the treaty. And all the while he was busy doing nothing, Louis XIV was playing his hand over in Madrid. His emissaries were offering up huge piles of money to every influential Spanish policymaker they could find. What are you after? An estate in France? Sure, got plenty to hand out. Want to marry a French nobleman's daughter? Say the word. Louis was offering up the mint. But if he succeeded, he would get the Spanish Empire. So there were two factions in the Spanish court, one for France and one for the Holy Roman Empire. The imperial faction was led by the queen, an Austrian, a Habsburg, but Louis sowed a lot of seeds. And when the royal council voted on who should succeed Carlos II to the throne, they voted for Philippe, the French king's grandson. In the official announcement, Carlos II wrote that, quote, "I declare my successor to be, should God take me without leaving heirs, the Duke of Anjou, second son of the Dauphin, and as such I call him to the succession in all my kingdoms and dominions without exception." End quote. Beyond that, though, Philippe's younger brother, the Duc de Berry, the backup, he was second in line. Only after him came Charles of Austria. Louis, King of France, had won.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Of course, William III was going to have a hard time accepting that outcome, as was Leopold I. Carlos II was still alive, he could still rewrite his will, so William and Leopold sent ambassadors to try to change his mind. But before they arrived, on the 1st of November, 1700, All Saints' Day, Carlos II of Spain died. 8 days later, word reached King Louis at Fontainebleau. The Council of Spain stood firmly behind Philippe for the crown. And you'd think that Louis would be over the moon at this news, but he was still nervous. He knew what it would mean. It was here that he said, when one begins a war, one does not know the finish. He had worked hard for this win, but he expected to have more time to secure the succession, to get everybody on board. Or maybe King Louis intended to, once he had the succession in hand, maybe he wanted to trade it to Emperor Leopold for Italy and all the goodwill that would win him. Either way, King Louis waffled. Everyone in Europe held their breath while Louis made his decision, and he was having trouble doing so. He said to one of his courtiers at this time, quote, "Whatever I do, I will be blamed by many people," end quote, and he was right about that. But despite the fact that war would become almost inevitable, despite years of starvation during the 9 Years' War, despite the empty French coffers and the weight of souls that would be on his conscience, Louis really only had one choice to make. On 14 November, a French ambassador departed for Madrid. Now, that French ambassador had to leave in secret. He departed under the cover of night, in disguise. Louis wanted to give his generals as long as possible to prepare for what might be coming. 10 days later, that secret ambassador presented King Louis's answer to the royal council in Madrid. That same day, Louis met with the Spanish ambassador in his private chambers in Versailles, and messengers departed for London and Vienna. It would be some time before it was really, really official, but that Spanish ambassador, when he entered the chambers of King Louis, Philippe was sitting there, and the Spanish ambassador knelt and kissed his ring. He hailed him as Philip V, King of Spain. It was announced to the people of France that Sunday at Mass. King Louis offered his grandson the cushion that he usually used to kneel in prayer. Philip V demurred, so both men, as they were now both of them kings, they each knelt without a pillow. It was political theater, but the word was now out. Everyone knew what this meant. It made it even clearer when the king's agents rode out to every city and every township in the kingdom announcing a levy of conscripts for the army. Louis was intent on securing and keeping the Spanish throne for his grandson. In London and Vienna, though, things weren't quite so clear. The will that left the throne to Philip V, now King of Spain, was legally binding and legitimate. He was the rightful King of Spain. If they wanted a war, they would have to find a solid casus belli to start it. As James Faulkner writes in The War of the Spanish Succession, quote, "Suspicions of Louis XIV's motives were lively, but Parliament in London would almost certainly not vote funds for a new war, even if there had been a sound argument for such a dramatic course." And that, it seemed, was that. End quote. William III and The Hague both sent messengers to Vienna and Madrid announcing that they were going to acknowledge Philip as King Philip V of Spain. Soon enough, messengers from every court in Europe began to depart with their own letters announcing their acceptance of Philip V. Poland, Prussia, and notably here, the House of Hanover in Germany. They all agreed that Philip V was the rightful King of Spain. The ascension of King Philip seemed to be a fait accompli. And for a year, that's how things stayed. Philip arrived in Madrid and was formally received by the people to cheering and celebrations. A few weeks later, he was crowned King of Spain. Then it came time to see him married. Now, Philip was still only 18, so his grandfather oversaw the decision, and there were a lot of good candidates. But the best candidate was down south, in a region that was newly allied to King Louis and King Philip, and who would be integral to their plans in the future. King Louis decided upon the 12-year-old daughter of the Duke of Savoy, Maria Luisa Gabriella. Maria Luisa and King Philip were to be married by proxy while she was still in Savoy. It was to be a few more months after she turned 13 when she finally departed for Spain. She was greeted in Nice by the Pope, who granted her a golden rose. It was a formal declaration that he approved of this union between Savoy and Spain. Now, if you're thinking that this union was bad news for Leopold, you would be 100% right. The alliance between Savoy and France was stronger now than it ever had been, and that alliance included Spain and Portugal. That's everyone west of the Holy Roman Empire. And south of the Holy Roman Empire, because, with his ascension to King of Spain, because Leopold didn't sign that treaty, Philip V was still in charge of Naples, Sicily, and Milan. That is quite a coalition against the empire. The marriage between Maria Luisa and King Philip was a bit rocky at first. Maria Luisa was smart, willful, and 13 years old. She was angry over the fact that she wouldn't be able to keep all of her courtiers from Savoy. She also really did not care for her chaperone sent by her father to make sure that she did everything she was supposed to do. She refused to join her husband in the marital bed. It turned into a minor diplomatic scandal, but King Louis sent some advice to his grandson. It's an interesting enough read, but it breaks down to basically remember that your queen is your first subject. You're the king. She can't do whatever she wants, and you need her to remember that. Maria Luisa learned that lesson soon enough. However, it appears that their marriage actually turned into a happy one. One hesitates to use words like love, especially when you're talking about a 13-year-old, but in any royal marriage, that's a nebulous concept. However, Maria Luisa always showed affection toward her husband publicly, at least as far as was proper, and it seems to have been genuine. The two seem to have really enjoyed each other's company. One last note, though, about Maria Luisa's family. Her grandmother, on her mother's side, was Henrietta of England, the Duchesse d'Orléans. Henrietta, remember, was that Stuart, the sister of Charles II and James II. A woman who, in a place like England, where women could hold the throne, wound up having a pretty excellent claim a few years down the road. For some Jacobites, Henrietta of England, and later on, her granddaughter, would be kind of a figurehead for the Jacobite cause. Remember, never take your eyes off the Jacobites. Meanwhile, though, two really big things happened. First of all, Spain made an important trade decision. Portugal, at this point in her history, wasn't really autonomous. They were little more than a vassal state for the Spanish. Which means, now, they were little more than a vassal state for the French. King Philip V made a big, momentous trade decision. He signed over the trading rights for all of the African slave trade, which had been the purview of Portugal since the Treaty of Tordesillas. He signed those rights over to France. Here's the thing, though. Portugal had always been on pretty good terms with England and the Netherlands and King William III. They'd never had any problem selling human beings to English and Dutch colonies in the New World. France, on the other hand, had really big problems with England and the Netherlands and King William, and they were going to have really big problems selling human beings to any of their colonies. It was a shocking turn of events as far as global economics go. It was a huge hit to the maritime powers, England and the Netherlands. That, in itself, was probably enough to ensure that war was now coming. But then, as spring broke in 1701, forces began to skirmish with one another. In northwest Italy, there are three main regions that are going to concern us here today. To the far northwest, there's Savoy. South of that was Piedmont. Piedmont and Savoy now were both in the French orbit. To the west of Piedmont, though, there was Lombardy, which was in the Holy Roman Empire's orbit. Lombardy included the smaller duchy of Milan. Along the border between Piedmont and Lombardy, Italian troops, those loyal to the Empire on one side and the French on the other, they were already fighting. This was before anyone had gone so far as to declare war. One contemporaneous historian wrote, quote, "After some time, the war, waited for and expected by all Europe, at last broke out, by some imperialist troops firing upon a handful of men near Alboreto. One Spaniard was killed, and all the rest of the party taken prisoner. The king, Louis XIV, upon hearing this, at once dispatched the general officers to Italy. Our troops were to be commanded by Catinat, under Monsieur de Savoy." French troops were sent to the south under Marshal Catinat, who served directly under the Duke of Savoy. And that French army invaded the Duchy of Milan. Catinat, though, in his push to take the city and the Duchy of Milan, was overmatched. He was forced to retreat back to Piedmont. King Louis was upset by this turn of events and dispatched a much better Marshal of France to replace him. This new Marshal was François de Neufville, Duc de Villeroy. We're going to call him from here on out simply Villeroy. He was Louis's most trusted military commander and a personal friend to the king, going back years now. When Villeroy departed France, Louis told him, quote, "I cannot tell you how pleased I am to have you in command. I have reason to believe you will finish the campaign gloriously, but take care of yourself. You know how necessary you are to me." End quote. And Villeroy did indeed know. He knew more than about anybody else in Europe how necessary he was to King Louis. On September 1st, 1701, a combined force of French, Spanish, and Savoyard troops attacked the entrenched positions of the imperial general Eugenie. The battle didn't go well for the French. Marshal Catinat, now commanding the left wing of the army, was shot in the head and killed. Villeroy was there to do what generals are supposed to do, you know, give tactical orders, but his commander-in-chief, the Duke of Savoy, was also on the scene giving his own, often contradictory, orders. Very quickly, the ranks were filled with confusion about exactly what they were supposed to do, and they were unable to make the push into Milan. They were forced to retreat once again back to Piedmont. King Louis was displeased, as you might imagine, and he reprimanded his friend Villeroy, but not too harshly. He knew that the Duke of Savoy was a nuisance, but he also knew they needed the Duke of Savoy. He ordered Villeroy to put his men in winter quarters. But then Louis told Villeroy to ride north. The Italian front was important, absolutely, and we'll get a commander down there to do the job, but nothing in this war was as important as the Rhineland. 7 days after that first major encounter of the war, King William III ordered John Churchill, 1st Duke of Marlborough, to sail for the Netherlands. There, Marlborough sat in on a council with Leopold I and the commanders of the Allied Imperial and Dutch troops. No English troops, not yet, aside from Marlborough himself and a few of his advisors. And Marlborough wasn't even really there to take part in the council, officially speaking. England, their parliament, had still not voted to declare war on France. Marlborough was really only there to audit the council. But everyone there knew that Marlborough was the best field commander they had. He had been sidelined for a large portion of the 9 Years' War, thanks to a bunch of political maneuverings back home, but he was still the best commander in the Allied camp. So while he didn't take part, quote-unquote, in this council, his advice was sought whenever they made actual plans for battle. The implicit understanding here is that when Parliament finally got their heads on straight and voted to enter the war, it was going to be Marlborough who executed those plans in the field. Next time, the Duke of Marlborough will indeed execute those plans. His Rhineland campaign is going to go down in history as one of the greatest and most famous military campaigns ever seen. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who helps to support this show, everybody who has left us ratings or reviews, everybody who has recommended this show, and all of our supporters on Patreon. Without all of you, this wouldn't be possible. So thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, you absolutely should do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com. The Pirate History Podcast is a member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. If you'd like to check out some of their other fine shows, like The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast, you can do so at airwavemedia.com. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening.
Live on in legend tonight.